Okay, very good. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavitvishavahai. Om Shanti 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 Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarvabhuta Guhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarva Vide Namaha. Om. Good. Welcome to you all here. I'll show our online students. We have a full house today, I think, because it is Guru Purnima. Nice. Nice to have you all come and join us. Oh, nice. Good. So we'll have a very good class today. Welcome also to the many students who are regularly watching these classes online, attending these classes online. We continue with our study of chapter 17. We just began it, and today we shift topic, and since with a shift of topic, we really need to have context. Also, with a lot of students who haven't been coming regularly, it's important to have the context properly. This chapter opened with a very bold statement. It said, Atma labho para nasti. There is no attainment in life greater than Atma, your true self, the so-called inner divinity. And I suggested at that time to take that statement as a proposition that was going to be unfolded and established through the verses in this chapter, and that's what we're engaged in right now, seeing Sri Shankaracharya unfold that important teaching. And as anything in Vedanta, whatever is to be established must rest solidly on three so-called pillars of Vedanta. I know there our Muslim friends talk about five pillars of Islam, so it's maybe not an appropriate metaphor, but why not? So we'll call them three pillars of Vedanta, which means that upon which the teachings of Vedanta rest. Those pillars, as our regular students know very well, as Shruti, Yukti, and Anubhava. Shruti, scripture, scriptural revelation, the teachings of the ancient rishis. Yukti, reasoning. You all know that Advaita Vedanta has a lot of very rational kinds of teachings. And finally, Anubhava, personal experience. Both your personal experience and the personal experience of great saints and sages from whom we learn. So what that three pillar principle means is anything that's taught has to be consistent with all three. Both, it has to be supported by scripture, it has to be supported by reasoning, and it has to be consistent with your own personal experience. And if it's not so, that teaching is rejected. And I mean rejected. Shankaracharya is famous for saying, I think in his Bhagavad Gita commentary, that if 1,000 scriptural statements were to say fire is cold, Shankara, the greatest teacher of Vedanta and follower of the Vedas, says, I would reject every one of those scriptures, Shankaracharya says. So just to show the importance of this threefold approach. Now, our context in the text today is Shankara has already backed up that statement. The statement that there is no greater gain other than Atma. He's already backed that up with Anubhava and Yukti. Anubhava, experience. How does experience establish the fact that there's no greater gain than Atma. Too easy, and by the way, we could spend a whole class on each one of these, so we'll make this introduction fairly brief so we can continue with our text. Just making sure this is okay. It looks okay. So Anubhava establishes that truth by... Yeah, if you need to adjust the volume, you have to open up the front panel. The front panel pops open, and then you'll find a volume control inside. And maybe a volunteer can help him. All right. It was an assistive listening device. All right. What does Anubhava, your personal experience, tell you? Well, your personal experience tells you that any source of happiness or contentment, any experience of happiness or contentment you have in life is fleeting, impermanent, comes and goes. You've never had... Well, if there were such a thing as a permanent source of happiness, I presume you would have found it by now, and therefore you wouldn't be sitting here in class today. You wouldn't need any of these teachings. So just to make the very obvious point, and that is your own experience tells you very clearly there is no such thing as a permanent source of happiness that you can experience in life. On the other hand, every time you sit down to meditate, you close your eyes, and as your mind becomes increasingly quiet, what do you find? Happiness, contentment, peace. Every time your mind becomes quiet, might not be every time you meditate, because every time you meditate it might not work so well, but every time your mind becomes quiet, you definitely find contentment and peace and happiness inside. So this is Anubhava, one of the three pillars. Yukti, reasoning, we've just finished with that section, and Shankara has established it in this way. It says, for something to be permanent, we're talking about the context again, is for Atma to be the highest attainment in life, it has to be something that doesn't come and go. Anything that comes and goes, anything that's impermanent, anything that's transient, isn't what we seek. We don't seek moments of happiness in life. We seek lasting happiness. Uninterrupted contentment is what we seek. So anything that comes and goes isn't good enough, so to speak. And Yukti, reasoning, Shankara uses to establish the fact that Atma is the highest gain because it doesn't come and go because, here's the reasoning, we have reasons and reasons, so Atma is the highest attainment because it doesn't come and go. Why doesn't it come and go? Because it's your swarupa, your essential nature. It's who you are in an essential way. Your true nature being consciousness. This has been the main topic all the way through this text, so we're not going to talk about it. But just to make sure that we don't understand consciousness in a conceptual way, consciousness is present in your experience right now, allowing you to know what's happening inside your mind and inside this room. Consciousness is that by which you are aware of whatever is happening right now. That's our Vedantic definition of consciousness. Science and medicine have other kinds of definitions. Set them aside. It doesn't apply here. Consciousness is that awareness, and we use the two words interchangeably. They're synonyms. So what we've established then, or what Shankara has established then, is that the true nature of the consciousness which is present in your mind right now, its essential nature is happiness, contentment, and peace, which is why every time This, I went over it quickly, but it's so significant. Suppose when you sat down to meditate, you closed your eyes, and the quieter your mind became, the worse you felt. Suppose you feel like you're sinking down into an abyss of nothingness, and it's very scary and uncomfortable. Well, that's not how it feels for anyone. Like deep sleep. We all love the bliss of dreamless sleep. We all love that condition of meditation. So that's back to the anubhava part, the experience part. But what it shows is that contentment isn't something you get. It's who you are. We say the true nature of consciousness, Atma, is Sat-Chit Ananda. That word Ananda refers to consciousness as the unchanging, unwavering source of perfect inner peace and contentment. And it doesn't come and go because it's who you are. That's the yukti. That's the reason that Shankara has just used. So Atma is the highest gain because anubhava tells you anything else comes and goes. Yukti, reasoning, tells you it doesn't come and go because it's who you are. So having established that opening statement, Atma is the highest gain possible, having established it with both experience and reasoning, now the third pillar, which is Shruti, scripture. And that's where we pick up the thread today. Here. Okay. Repeat after me, and always read the translation as I'm chanting, and then repeat after me. Karma karyastva nityasyat, karma karyastva nityasyat, avidya kama karanaha, avidya kama karanaha. Pramanam verahe vatra, pramanam verahe vatra, jnanasyadhigame smritaha, jnanasyadhigame smritaha. The first half we saw in last week's class, and it was the conclusion of that section on yukti, so since we've seen it completely in a prior class. By the way, for the newcomers, all of these classes are available online on our YouTube channel, so you can go back and catch up if you want to. Go to the last line. Jnanasya adhigame smritaha. Smritaha. There is a teaching that is remembered, and the teaching comes from the Vedas, as we'll see in just a moment. That teaching about what? Adhigame jnanasya. The teaching about the adhigama, the acquisition, jnanasya, of knowledge. So the Vedas teach something about the acquisition of knowledge. Go up to the prior line. Those atra, with regard to the acquisition of knowledge, Vedaha, scriptures, the Veda is pramanam, an authoritative source. An authoritative source means it's Shruti, Shruti referring to these scriptures which are accepted in Vedanta as one of the three pillars. So the Vedas, Shruti, those scriptures are a pramanam. Pramana is in Advaita Vedanta, it's used in a technical sense. I think Hindi may, you know, praman is someone who's an authority, is perhaps how it's taken. But it has a much more technical meaning in its Sanskrit usage in Advaita Vedanta. Pramana is, the best translation would be valid source of knowledge. There's no one-word translation for it. A valid source of knowledge. And that means there can be many. If in Hindi it suggests a person who's an authority or a book who's an authority, but here, sources of valid knowledge can be many, one of them being your five senses. Right now, your eyes are open, you see me. Your eyes are a pramana. Your eyes are a valid source of knowledge. You see my presence here on the chair. So there's one category of pramana, which are your five senses. So your five senses constitute one. We call that pratyaksha. Pratyaksha is a general term for anything perceived with your five senses. That's one kind of pramana. Another kind of pramana we talked about just now is yukti. Reasoning is another kind of pramana. You know, the classical example is when you see smoke rising from the mountain. You know that mountains aren't on fire. Mountains don't burn. Mountains are made of stone, rock, dirt, and all of that. But you know that there is some trees or wood. Something is on fire on that mountain. So seeing the smoke, you infer the presence of fire. That inferential knowledge comes from inference. Inference in Sanskrit, anumana. Anumana then is a second means of valid knowledge. So here we have two valid means of knowledge. Pratyaksha, that which you gain through your senses. Anumana, that which you gain through inference, logic, reasoning. And the final one, the technical word for it is shabda pramana. Shabda means words. So a pramana in the form of words, but not just any form of words. Words of the scripture. Words of an enlightened person. So the words of scripture, and by the way, the words of scripture are the words of enlightened persons, the ancient rishis from whom we receive these teachings. So shabda pramana, a valid means of knowledge in the form of words, words coming from scripture, words coming from an enlightened person. So, by the way, this turns out to be a big topic because different schools of thought accept or reject different pramanas. They each have their own, they pick and choose, so to speak. So Advaita Vedanta has six, other schools will have three or four or five, and we won't get into all those details. Mostly these three encompass things fairly well. So, we know through the Vedas say that Atma is the highest goal of life there's our third pillar. So we said in the opening statement, Atma is the highest goal of life. For that to be acceptable, it has to meet all three criteria. So it does meet the criteria of experience, anubhava. It does meet the criteria of yukti, reasoning. And here, we're seeing Shankara point out the fact that it is also declared in the scripture. Notice, if it were only declared in the scripture and not supported by experience and reasoning, Shankara himself would reject it, as he said with the case of the fire. So it is a third support for the acceptance of a teaching. Of course, there's something missing. This is actually quite important, but we wouldn't spend too much time on it. What's missing is when you first get this information, it's just that. You get it as information at first. You get it that you understand that all it's anubhava, all other experiences of happiness come and go. You get that. You get it that when you're quiet in meditation, you discover a contentment and happiness that doesn't come and go. And you get it that the scriptures say that your true nature, Atma, is Satchidananda Atma. You get all of that. So what? You understand lots of things. Everything that you've understood in life, none of that has brought you permanent contentment and inner peace. So what you've heard here is just one more little bit of information which is useless. Information is not what Advaita Vedanta is about. We use information. These are tools. This is a huge topic. I don't want to get sidetracked on it today, but to explain a metaphor, I think that's quite effective, is to compare the teachings of Vedanta to a roadmap. Now, I understand today no one uses roadmap. When was the last time you used a roadmap? Anyway, when I started teaching in the 1990s, there was no GPS in your car, so I got pretty familiar with roadmaps because I was going all over the place and teaching. I got lost a lot, and I'd have to figure out where I was. So anyway, roadmaps are very familiar to me, but you know what roadmaps are. Here's the point. On a roadmap, there's a tremendous amount of information. What cities are where? What roads connect all the cities, where the roads lead to, what are the names of the roads, what are the names of the cities, lots of information, like there's lots of information in the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. But if you memorize all the information on a roadmap, you've missed the point. The point of that roadmap is not to convey information. It has information. But the point of the roadmap is to lead you to your destination. It's a matter of how you use the roadmap. If you use the roadmap incorrectly, you know, I don't know why you would do so, but if you memorize all the information on the roadmap, you're wasting your time. In the same way, and here I have to say, the vast majority of spiritual seekers use Vedanta's teachings incorrectly. Really. They're busy memorizing the information. And by focusing on the information, they're failing to use these teachings properly to guide them to a destination. So this is such an important point, we couldn't skip over it. It's not our topic here, so we'll set it aside right now. These teachings are not for the sake of conveying information. These teachings are for the sake of leading you on a process of self-inquiry, atma-vichara, self-inquiry, and guiding you on that process to lead you to enlightenment. Okay, enough. We don't want to get sidetracked here. Let us continue. Jnanaikarthaparatvatam Jnanaikarthaparatvatam Vakyamekam tato viduhu Vakyamekam tato viduhu Ekatvam hyatmano gnyeyam Ekatvam hyatmano gnyeyam Vakyartha pratipattitaha vakyartha pratipattitaha. you need to introduce this this verse a little bit. By the way, this is not considered an introductory text, although I'm doing my best to make it accessible. So this is a text which deals with many objections to the teachings of Vedanta. In Sanskrit, we call these objections purvapaksha. And the Sanskrit commentaries on this text will actually write out what are the objections. So in preparing for this class, I read those commentaries, and one purvapaksha goes like this. The Vedas, if the Vedas support that opening statement, that Atma is the highest goal of life, the objection is, wait a minute, most of the Vedas teach rituals. The Vedas are broadly separated into Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. The Karmakanda is huge, where all the rituals are taught. The Jnanakanda, where Vedanta is taught, is very small. So the argument goes, how can you consider the Vedas to be scriptural support for the teaching that Atma is the highest goal? How can you make that conclusion when the majority of the Vedas don't teach Atma? Most of the Vedas is dedicated to teaching you how to perform various rituals. That's a fact. So this verse is a response to that objection. And Shankara says in the third line, Tataha Viduhu. The Viduhu, they know. The wise people know. Tataha. Because they have studied the Vedas properly. Properly means, I have to say this, properly means not on your own. To be honest, scriptural study, if it's not done with some proper guidance, is not going to be helpful for two reasons. One is you're not reading anyway the scripture, you're reading a translation unless you know Sanskrit. So if you don't know Sanskrit, you're not reading the scripture. Basically, every translation has its weaknesses. There's no such thing as a perfect translation. You can't translate words perfectly, and you can't convey these subtle thoughts. Plus, every translator will put their own spin on things. Every translator, including me. When I translate Bhagavad Gita, I present it as a text on Advaita Vedanta. When I teach Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, I put a very strong Advaitic spin on those Yoga Sutras. They don't teach Advaita, I make them teach it. Because I'm a teacher of Advaita Vedanta. So if you don't want Advaita Vedanta, don't come to me, don't come to this ashram. The point I'm saying is there's no such thing as an objective translation. Full stop. Secondly, even if there is, in order to understand a part, you need to understand the whole. Right? Think about that just for a moment. My teacher, Pujya Swami Naisan, Guru Purnima, we can first of all study with a guru of guru, Shankaracharya, and also it makes me remember this point that my teacher often made. He said to understand any particular part of the scripture, you have to understand the whole. When you're a student, do you understand the whole? No, that's why you're a student. So you need a teacher, you need a guru, someone who's already studied the whole thing and can tell you where that part fits in. One of the biggest mistakes people make in scriptural study is you take statements out of context and twist the meaning. Everyone takes things out of context. And favorite example is everyone quotes, and incorrectly, Ekam Sat Vipra Bahudha Varanti. Most of you have heard this famous quotation. Comes from early in the Rig Veda. And it says, Ekam Sat. Sat is one. Vipraha, the wise ones, bahudha, in many ways, varanti, describe that which is sat. Everyone translates sat as truth, which it can mean. But if you read the verse before that, and if you read the second half of that verse, that's first line of a verse, the line after it is talking about various gods. Indra, Agni, Varuna. The verse before is talking about other gods. Vayu, Brahasmi, any god you want to think of, those gods, Aryamas, specifically mentioned, the god of the ancestors. Look at this. The verse before is talking about gods. The line after is talking about gods. So Sat means truth? Or does Sat mean God? God is one. The wise ones describe that one God in many ways. Wasn't talking about truth at all. But you've probably seen that statement many times. And every time you've seen it, it was mistranslated. Truth is one. It's not teaching about truth. Anyway, the point I'm making is that scriptures can't be studied on your own. Any scripture needs to be studied with some proper guidance. You can't just look, even if you know Sanskrit. You pull that verse out of context and you mistranslate it, which is exactly what happens all the time. So, viduhu, those who understand the Vedas properly, tataha, because they have been properly taught by others, what do they know? They know that tam vakyam ekam. They know that tam, that, the wisdom that comes from the Vedas, is ekam vakyam. It consists of one teaching. And I'll make this point in just a moment. Remember, we're dividing now Vedas into Karma Kanda and Jnana Kanda. And then we're saying by weight, the Karma Kanda is much heavier, so to speak, than the Jnana. It's much longer than the Jnana Kanda. But here it says, viduhu, those who really understand the Vedas properly, they know something you may not know. They know that the Karma Kanda and the Jnana Kanda have ekavakyata, is the Sanskrit term for unity of meaning or intent. They have one purpose, ekam vakyam. The teachings of the Vedas have one purpose, and the reason is given in the first line, jnana eka artha paratvat. We have to break the words apart. Because the teachings of the Vedas have paratvat, because they are focused on jnana eka artha. The eka artha, the one ultimate purpose of the Vedas, is jnana, knowledge of your true self, not karma. This is a typical division. Jnana karma, karma kanda. And Shankara says here boldly, those who really know the Vedas know that the karma kanda is meant to prepare you for the jnana kanda. The karma kanda, the purpose of those rituals, if you are interested in moksha, let's make this is another big, big topic, we'll make it very short. If you are interested in moksha, if your goal in life is enlightenment, which rituals should you perform for the sake of getting enlightenment? There are hundreds of rituals described in the Karma Kanda of the Vedas. Which of those rituals, or which combination of those rituals, will make you enlightened? Many of you can answer this question. The answer is, you don't get enlightened by doing rituals. The maximum you can achieve through rituals is you collect lots of punya karma, and when you die, you get to enjoy the fruits of those karmas. Maybe you go to heaven, and in some heavenly abode, you enjoy whatever is there. But then, those karmas get exhausted, used up, fructified, and then you start over again. I've been using the example that chutes and ladders game. That's the one. Zip. No, and no matter how high you, it's like in the game, no matter how high you go, there's one chute that'll take you all the way to the bottom. So no matter how high of a heaven you reach through your performance of rituals, you get reborn. So viduhu, the wise ones understand that. They understand that the karmakanda is not meant to lead you to moksha. The karmakanda is meant to prepare you for the jnanakanda, where the teachings, where these teachings come from, where the teachings of Advaita Vedanta come from. Upanishads. Upanishads are found in the Jnanakanda of the Vedas. So Shankara says the objection here was that, you know, how can you say the Vedas support Atma? Finding Atma is the ultimate goal of life. And the objection comes that most of the Vedas are dedicated to rituals. And the response here is, well, people who really understand the Vedas properly understand that rituals are secondary. Rituals prepare you for the profound teachings of the rishis found in the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. And then he concludes, Shankara concludes here, ekatvam hi atmanah jnayam vakyarta pratipatitaha. He says the ekatvam, yeah, breaking apart the words he, because atmanah ekatvam, the oneness of Atma, jnayam, is to be known, is to be discovered. And oneness of Atma with what? The oneness of Atma with Brahman. Notice Shankara doesn't say all of that. These verses, as I said, this isn't an introductory text, so verses are very terse, and therefore you have to be ready to read between the lines, so to speak. You have to kind of, when I prepare for a class, I think of it as crawling inside of Shankaracharya's mind, so to speak, so I can understand his flow of thought. And Shankara's flow of thought here is when you study enough, you get to that point. You know, it's like with a spouse or a dear one. Have you noticed you can almost read their minds, right? So it's like that. If you study Shankara enough, you can get inside his mind, so to speak. So what Shankara is saying here is that the oneness of Atma, and by the way, commentators also say the same thing. So if you don't get inside of Shankara's mind, you better study those commentaries. So the oneness of Atma means the oneness of Atma with Brahman, which is the highest teaching of Vedanta expressed in Mahavakyas like Tat Tvam Asi. Tat, that Brahman, Tvam, your essential nature as Atma, Asi, you are. Your essential nature is Atma, Tvam, Tat Asi, you are that Brahman. This is the culminating teaching of the Vedanta, the Jnana Karma. So if you think the Karma Kanda prepares you for the Jnana Kanda prepares you for the Mahavakya. That's how it works. There's a sequence. There's a method. Vedanta is methodology. So the method is you get prepared for this wisdom, Karmakanda, then you study the teachings of the ancient rishis, Jnanakanda, and eventually you you gain enlightenment through the Mahavakya, like Tat Tvam Asi. So you gain enlightenment, Gnayam, by understanding the oneness of Atma with Brahman, Vakyartha Pratipattitaha. And here I would, if you, by the way, these slides you can print out, and I'm constantly correcting my own translation. Pratipatti does not mean meaning. Pratipatti means understanding, recognition. So you have the pratipatti, the recognition of vakya artha, the meaning of the vakya, and here vakya refers specifically to Mahavakya. Again, reading between the lines, vakya could mean any statement, but reading, crawling inside of Shankara's mind, you know that he's referring to Mahavakya Tattvamasi. So, through the teachings of the Vedas, you come to gain enlightenment through Tattvamasi. As I said, you start with Karmakanda, you progress to Jnanakanda, and finally, you gain enlightenment through the Mahavakya, like Tat Tvam Asi. Tat Tvam Asi is found in the Vedas, and in this way, the Vedas are that third pillar supporting the fact that Atma is the greatest gain in life, supported not just by experience and reasoning, supported also by scripture. End of topic. Now, if you notice, by verse 17.9, verse 9 is followed by verse 14. What happened to the intervening verses? You know that I'm taking the freedom to skip over some verses here. As I said, this is not an introductory text. And Shankara gets into topics that if you don't have adequate background, you won't understand what he's teaching. For example, earlier in this, we skipped over a section dealing with Vaisheshika Nyaya Matas there, and Baudha Mata, the technical teachings of Buddhism and the schools of thought known as Nyaya and Vaisheshika and Sankhya. Unless you studied this thoroughly, you won't understand Shankara's teachings on that. So I'm taking those particular sections and taking them out. There's another section here that's been removed. So this, the verse we just saw dealt with Tattvamasi. So Shankara now introduces another opposing point of view, another Purvapaksha. And he says, how can tat equal tvam? So the statement tat tvamasi is like mathematics. Tat equals tvam. That's like A equals B. Wait a minute. A equals A. B equals B. A doesn't equal B. A is A, B is B, they're different. Tat is tat, tvam is tvam, they're different. And then he gets into a big linguistic analysis. If you have studied Sanskrit linguistics, you can go and study these verses on your own. If you haven't studied Sanskrit linguistics, it's not going to be helpful. If you don't know the logical defect called anyonyashrama, anyonya ashrama, it's ashraya, sorry, anyonyashraya, translated as mutual dependence. If you don't know the principle of anyonyashraya, which Shankara uses in these verses, it won't make any sense. I'm just making this point so you know that these verses are not arbitrarily removed. It's highly technical. And what I find is, and I'm surprised by this, that if you remove these verses, you don't miss out on anything, because it's a little bit like when we talk and when we teach, we often go on tangents. Do you ever go off on a tangent? We all do. I do. My guru went on incredible tangents when he taught. He'd go all over the place, and then he'd land exactly where he left off. He had that amazing skill. So, if everyone goes off in tangents, couldn't Shankara go off on a tangent? And some of you have done editing, and you may have discovered when you edit, when you remove tangents, the text becomes more comprehensible. It's actually improved by pruning away the unnecessary material. That's how an editor would look at something. So I guess I'm taking that role of editor here and trying to remove the tangents, but only tangents that are too technical to handle. So having removed that tangent, we come back. Let's see. Yeah. Just checking the time. I think we're okay. We come back actually to Tattvamasi. Tattvamasi now is going to be established here in a unique way. I've mentioned before that there are some things that we've seen taught in this text, Upadesha Sahasri, which aren't regularly taught. There's some brilliant insights and brilliant methods of teaching. And here we're going to see one. Tattvamasi is going to be established by comparing the dream state and the waking state. Now, commonly, we use dream and waking and deep sleep states. This analysis is fundamental to Advaita Vedanta. We use it again and again and again. Shankara has used it again and again and again. But there's something unique here. And the uniqueness here is Shankara is going to use it very deftly to support the Mahavakya Tat Tvam Asi. How can Tvam be Tat? How can your let me describe this. How can Tvam be Tat? How can your individual consciousness be the underlying reality because of which everything exists? I'll say that again. Tvam is your individual consciousness. Tat is Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. So we can ask that question very legitimately. How can your individual consciousness be identical to the reality because of which everything exists? And that's what's revealed in the Mahavakya, and that's what Shankara is going to explain here in a unusual way, but a very powerful way, by using dream as a metaphor and then talking about waking state. Let's see that. Yena veti sa veda syat, yena veti sa veda syat, swapne sarvam tu mayaya, swapne sarvam tu mayaya, yena pashyati tat chakshuhu, yena pashyati tat chakshuhu, shrunoti shrotramuchyate, shrunoti shrotramuchyate. In the second line, swapne, in a dream. In a dream, what a statement. Yena veti, that by which you know what's happening in your dream, sahavedaha syat, that is the same as what you're knowing. Yena veti, that by which you know, means consciousness. How do you know what's happening right now? You're conscious of what's happening, as I said, in this room and in this room, the room of your mind. You are aware of what's happening. You are conscious of what's happening. But now in this room, there's a very obvious separation going on. Consciousness is here, and I am here. You are there, you are the conscious observer, and I am the object being observed over here. There's a very obvious separation, but not in a dream. Suppose, just for fun, suppose this is a dream. You're dreaming about on Guru Purnima day, you went to Arshabodha Center and you attended Swami Taratman's class. This is your dream. Nice dream. Better than a nightmare. Okay. So, you're having this nice dream. So, in this dream, you are the consciousness aware of Swami Tadatmananda teaching. Swami Tadatmananda is sitting on a chair teaching. What is the chair made of in your dream? Right? This chair is made of wooden fabric. What is the chair in your dream made of? Not wooden fabric. Consciousness. You. What it, here, Swami Taratmananda is made of flesh and bone. What is the Swami Taratmananda in your dream made of? Consciousness. So look at the difference. Here there's separation. You are the conscious observer. Swami Taratmananda is the object observed. Not in a dream. In a dream, you are the conscious observer, and everything you observe are forms of consciousness. What is a dream? Form in consciousness. And this is another text. We've, by the way, if you're coming new, this is a topic Shankara has talked about many times in prior classes. We won't go further into it right now. Thoughts are basically forms of consciousness. Shankara has established this very well. So here's the uniqueness of the dream situation. He says, yena veti, that by which you know something in a dream, and saha vedaha, and that which is known in a dream, syat, they're the same. Knower and known are the same in a dream. Got it? Here, knower and known are different. You're over there, I'm over here. Distance, separation, difference between knower and known. That is not so in the dream, which is what Shankara says. Saha vedaha, what you see in a dream, and yena veti, and that by which you know what's happening in a dream, they are the same. One consciousness takes the role of knower, the same consciousness takes the form of chair and Swami and everything else known. One consciousness in the form of knower and known. Now that's very significant because this knower-known relationship is fundamental to our ordinary experience. But you may not have thought about it in a dream, and I'm just kind of looking at the clock and revising our lesson plan. Okay, because there are certain points of landing where you have to end the class, and so we're going to have to end here. So let's work on this a little bit. Why do we use this dream metaphor so extensively in Advaita Vedanta? And it is. Many of you know that this dream metaphor is used again and again, not just by Shankara, but by every teacher of Vedanta. Why? Because it shows how what we think is real is not as real as we think it is. Right now, you're awake, I think. Yeah, I'm looking to see if... if the class is really boring, then you know what happens. It's okay. So everyone is still awake. Good. So this all seems so real. But Vedanta says is it's not as real as it seems. And not only Vedanta says, today we have the benefit of science to tell us also that the world is not as real as it seems to be. My favorite example, some of you have heard me give this several times. Everything is made of atoms. Atoms are almost entirely empty space. Right? You know, this tiny nucleus and even tinier electrons in a cloud around and in between, almost entirely empty space. My hand is made of atoms. This chair is made of atoms. So tell me, if my hand is mostly empty space and this chair is mostly empty space, why doesn't my hand pass through this chair? Why is there the experience of solidity? This is not a solid object, nor is the chair a solid object, but we sure experience them as solid objects. Here science is brilliant. And the answer, by the way, is not very intuitive. You remember something about similarly charged particles repelling each other? Positively charged particles repel? Negatively charged particles repel? On the outside of every atom are negatively charged electrons. On the outside of the atoms of my hand are negatively charged electrons. On the outside of the atoms in this chair are negatively charged electrons. Electrons repel. Isn't that counterintuitive? That's the truth of it. Electrons repel. Did you ever think about that? That's the truth. Your experience tells you the wrong thing. Your experience tells you this is a solid object, this is a solid object, and that's why. But that's not true. This is not a solid object. The chair is not a solid object. Experience misleads you all the time. The other example I've used on so many occasions is that you have never yet seen the sun go down. The sun doesn't go down. The earth turns. The sun is just sitting there. You're on this huge planet, tilting over backwards. Experience fools you all the time. And it turns out, if you make a mistake about the sun going down, that is a wrong interpretation of your experience, which doesn't have any big negative consequences. If you misinterpret this experience by thinking that your hand is a solid object and the chair is a solid object, that misinterpretation doesn't have any negative consequences. But if your body is sick and dying, and you are in pain, feeling terrible, how do you interpret that experience as a big consequence, tremendous consequence? In one situation, most people will conclude, I'm dying, and this is not fun. Dying is not fun. Anyone who dies quickly, it's a blessing. You all know that many people takes a while to die. It's not fun. Suffering. On the other hand, those who are enlightened also die, also go through the same excruciating process as the body slowly leaks out all the prana. The prana leaks out through any hole in your body, through these holes, these holes, these holes. All the prana leaks out. The enlightened person goes through exactly the same physical experience. But the enlightened person doesn't suffer, because the enlightened person has a radically different interpretation of that experience. So look at the difference between experience and your interpretation of your experience. Experience of solidity, where we can reinterpret that experience. Experience of the sun going down, but we can reinterpret that experience. The experience of dying, the enlightened person reinterprets that experience. And as a result of that interpretation, the enlightened person doesn't suffer. The body dies, all the same, experience is the same. Suppose you're watching the sun along with someone who works for NASA, the space agency, and you see the sun goes down. And the NASA employee says, no, it doesn't. Right? Or you're talking to a particle physicist, and you say, this is solid. The particle physicist says, no, it's not. Suppose you're dying. And you're suffering. You say, oh, this is horrible. The enlightened person says, no, it's not. It's a matter of how we interpret our experience. Honestly, the teachings of Vedanta, this is a very unconventional, and we'll end our class with this observation, is a very unconventional way of describing how the teachings of Advaita Vedanta make you free from suffering, what we call enlightenment. The teachings of Advaita Vedanta lead you to re-examine your experience of being a human being and learn how faulty your interpretation of those experiences are, and help you to remove all the wrong interpretations of your experiences of being a human being. And when all those wrong interpretations, wrong conclusions, let us call them, when all those wrong conclusions have been removed, what is left is your true nature as Satchitananda Atma, which is not subject to suffering. So this is really an important point here. This is why, we need not go there. This is really a helpful way to understand Vedanta, a solution to the problem of suffering that works by helping us correctly understand what we experience and help us remove wrong conclusions that make us suffer. It's like, since we're dealing with this dream metaphor, we'll pick up the dream metaphor in our next class, but it's like you're in a dream, and it's not a pleasant dream like this one. You're dreaming of coming to the ashram on Guru Purnima, but suppose you're having a nightmare. Horrible dream. Scary. You're running from some kind of monster. You're about to die. Whatever it is. And then you wake up. Gone. Advaita Vedanta works like that. You are in a dream of ignorance right now. A dream of wrong conclusions. And when those wrong conclusions are removed, you pop out of the dream and you discover, oh, everything's okay. Subtik, hey, you say, everything is okay. You get, when you wake, you don't say that when you're running from the monster in a dream, but as soon as you wake up, subtik, hey. In the same way, as soon as you wake up out of the dream of ignorance, you discover everything is okay. Well, nice to have you all here today. We'll conclude the prayer. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve
Bhavantu
Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhagbhavit, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityorma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat. All right. We stop this one and stop.